Today I want to talk about European social purpose and public service communication. I started off by having a list of caveats, which I've decided not to give you actually in the end. But I think it would be helpful if I just say where my interest's coming from many different aspects really of the issue of communications. I started off really a while ago writing about news and what constitutes a disposition towards truthfulness in journalism, underpinned, I thought, by accuracy and sincerity. And I put impartiality somewhere down the list, and it's interesting to hear about impartiality in that debate. So I started off thinking about the quality of conversation, really, that could occur from a journalistic point of view. But then in parallel to that, I was mad enough to take on another project, which was to write a book with a co-author, Lorna Wood, who's a lawyer. And we've just actually finished, and it's just at the proof stage, a book called EU Broadcasting Policy and Law. Not a very snappy title. It's quite worthy in the sense that what we've done is we've looked through the Television Without Frontiers directive in great detail. We've obviously tracked what's happening with the new Audiovisual Media Services Directive, but also the other broadcasting policy structures that exist in the EU, and of course have to have addressed all the issues of competence and what the EU can and can't do. And in the process of this long book, we started to think about, well, actually, you know, what's happening to the citizen in all this? Everything's skewing really in practice towards privatisation of information, towards prioritising consumer values. And alongside that, I started looking at the EU's communication strategy, which is all to do with how the EU wants to talk to people, which is a separate strand from its information society policy and its audiovisual policy, and started to think, well, I'm not sure that that's going to work. How is the EU going to talk to itself, to each other, to citizen to citizen? And so I was taken actually early as well by something that Georgina said about a public presence in the infrastructure. And that's really where my ideas for public service communication come from. So the mixture of all those aspects of dissatisfaction with some of the policy structures, having studied them in depth, but also in terms of what I would expect of information and news, but not just news, but broader aspects of information and communication that could be out there in the public domain. Now, of course, that's quite utopian in the sense that where do we start with all that? And I did start with public service broadcasters, but I'm going to move on because we've talked quite a lot about that. But just to say that, obviously, as a public service remit, we've traditionally been expected to be addressed as citizens rather than consumers. And particular types of public service content, even in this digitising world, are still regarded, really, as a social and civic asset. We can't lose sight of that. Public service communication infrastructures and their systems of governance therefore treat information as a public resource to be disseminated on behalf of the public good. Now, those models can be flawed, but we do see still examples of that existing. The problem, of course, is that, as we've said, well, we've heard quite a lot, that actually content is now disassociated from any particular platform, and it's today regarded as having to have a 360-degree application, and, you know, the idea is to maximise multiple revenue streams. And it's interesting if you just look at how ITV at the moment is talking about its ultra-local TV offering. It talks about it in terms of repurposing its content for ITV local, actually using existing content and repurposing. The BBC, that's absolutely dying to get into the same area, that has to pass a public value test, is talking about making new content for ultra-local TV, recognising that actually it is a different application. And that, to me, just separates or makes a distinction between commercial. ITV is a commercial public service broadcaster, or at least a broadcaster with obligations. And there is a difference between the rhetoric of both those organisations, but about the same application, which is about, you know, drilling down to the local level and obviously trying to engage people in some sort of conversation, some sort of public service communication. So the emergence for PSC, for me, having thought about it a while, is that In response to these new communicative challenges that are at large at the moment, PSC, I think, could be seen usefully as some sort of umbrella term for a variety of strands of new and traditional communicative activities. I'm sort of trying to gather things together in a way here. And I think if we can identify different strands that are already existing. One, of course, and central to this is public service broadcasters and public service broadcasting. Obviously, some of those have migrated onto the web and are, using interactive media to enhance whatever they do. They talk about value added, they talk about producing something different for citizens. I think part of this is also to do with trying to understand where a gateway or a portal or some sort of easily identifiable access to all that public communication out there exists. So public service communication could be conceptualized in that way, I think. And public service broadcasters, of course, at the European level have been encouraged by the European Parliament to make new technology available to public institutions and in public places. But of course, we know that the expansion of public service broadcasting, which happens obviously at the national level, actually leads to commercial competitors complaining about the extent to which state-aided broadcaster can or can't expand into these new services. And there isn't a lot of protection from the European level, really, about how public service broadcasters are going to be defined and how their remits may or may not be constrained by the definition they place upon themselves. I don't want to go into that. But obviously, public service broadcasting as a national institution, albeit supported at the European level through the protocol, which is actually non-binding in legal terms, is actually something that is, as we know, facing quite a lot of pressure and criticism from all sorts of directions, not least where it's going to go in the digital age. And in the UK setting, I think it's sort of reflecting some of the uncertainty, the fact that Ofcom, the regulator, is examining the value of establishing a public service publisher, which we talked a little bit, or we touched on yesterday, this idea that the license fee would be top sliced, and that instead of public service broadcasting just being the preserve of institutions, that it could actually be the preserve of particular programming strands and types and genres. Obviously, that always begs the question of what is it and where, who does it, and what constitutes public service broadcasting out of the institutional arena. But the idea is, to expand it. I suppose you could say that in theory, you could see that migrating into places, if there was the political will and the public funding, into IPTV and into places it's not been before. And that's the optimistic version. IPTV is interesting. I mean, we've got a channel a day emerging, more or less, and it's not regulated under the same terms as any other broadcasting service. So again, is that somewhere public service broadcasting or public service values could eventually be found? Other strands of PSC already exist, I think, in the form of things like e-government initiatives, which of course are top-down, and we know about the way that they're structured. But there has been recently, particularly at the EU level, a drive to make a lot more information accessible to citizens. Now, actually, there's too much information, and it's not that well presented in many cases. But nonetheless, it's there. It's just a case of making sense of it. And anyone who's trawled through all the European Union websites will know that it's quite a task to do that sometimes. In contrast, e-democracy initiatives, of course, or activities, are those that are capitalizing on peer-to-peer communication and networks. And this is really where we're seeing new opportunities to increase citizen participation in decision-making and more expansive forms of communication that could, in theory, create fora for, that sort of social-cultural conversation that we have been talking about. What I'm not certain to do, or where it fits, is the sort of 75 million blogs that are out there. Obviously, they're part and parcel of a communicative space that's opening up. But equally, I don't think we can just write them off. I mean, search engines such as Technocrati can actually isolate and locate them in terms of their subject matter. It could well be that, again, certain types of blogs could be gathered under some sort of rubric that is, or some sort of institution, I don't even know what to call it, a public service communication infrastructure. So from that point of view then, I think really where I want to go next is to go further into the utopian. And for Roger Silverstone, for the late Roger Silverstone, he encouraged us to think of the global media as a media polis, a single space of communication. And for him, of course, that communication space existed as both a reality and an ambition. Its normative dimension, I thought, was compelling because it envisages a space that is driven by responsibility, morality, respect for dignity of others. And of course, its mundane manifestation also has the potential to harm, intimidate, misform, and numerous other things. And I think that's, you know, what we think of the whole virtual communications network. The idea of a single global communicative space underpinned by morality and the recognition of dignity of difference is compelling, as is the idea of regulatory responsibility being shared between all communities of production, consumption and participation. So the regulatory dimension in this is open to question as well. How do you self-regulate or regulate amongst a group of interested communities? But for me today, and residing between the utopian media polis and the traditional national public service broadcaster, constrained as it is, lies the option for and the possibility of public service communication. And here for me, understood and defined as a communicative ambition which recognises the need for and the desirability of the multi-platform, technologically neutral mediation of public services, which both involve and stimulate participatory responsibility. So that is media services which are made available and are used in a self-reflective and self-determined way by, in my case, my example here, EU citizens. Okay, so how can we actually think about Europe's communication problems? Well, the question is actually where do you start, because there's so much going on. But obviously the EU citizens' disenchantment with the EU reached its height, who knows, with the rejection of the constitutional treaty by France and Netherlands in 2005. The reason for such a clear rejection was summarised by Peter Mandelson in a way I thought was quite interesting, and he talked about there being a lack of popular consensus on what Europe stands for and where it's going. In essence, though, Mandelson was talking about the democracy gap, the democratic deficit in EU governance, where the EU is actually judged to be remote, mysterious and irrelevant to those citizens supposedly affected by its workings. And in response to this, the EU has been trying to engage EU citizens to help them understand how the EU is governed. But this attempt at more open communication and accountability, I think, from looking at it, is extremely limited in scope and does not address the wider issues of the EU's political, cultural and social or even its economic purpose. So, to come back to my question, how can we rethink Europe's communication problems? One way is, and a difficult way, I admit, is to start with the umbrella idea or the term PSC. Admit its indebtedness to an evolution from public service broadcasting and describe it as consisting of a set of communication values which could, in theory, articulate a number of public purposes. On this paper, I shall obviously just confine it to European social purpose. I think PSC has a much wider application or conception than that. So to begin with, the values of PSC, in general, I see them as being about truthfulness, trust, independence, and respect for human dignity and diversity. Okay, so just very general values there, which obviously I can talk a bit more about. Obviously, time is short. But in short, these values actually support the belief that what is communicated in a PSC environment can be done so truthfully and therefore can be trusted, is critically independent of officialdom, and displays and reflect for human dignity, diverse expressions, and what Silverstone says, quoting Jonathan Sachs, the dignity of difference. Okay, so the dignity of difference, recognizing the other is different from me, but that I want to understand him or her. Together, these kind of values define both the purpose and use of a dedicated multi-platform, or could do, a multi-platform European communication network, the content it would carry, and the participatory responsibility needed to use such a network. And I see this, and I've written about this elsewhere, but basically that this network and content could actually constitute multiple opportunity bases for the transactional, participatory use of mediated public services, which actually support the reality of directly engaging and supporting the individual EU citizen. Obviously, for that to happen, you have the idea that PSC must actually function severally and simultaneously at the EU NGO and other civil society groups level, the EU citizen level, the citizen EU level, and the citizen to citizen level across all platforms. So I didn't say that I was going to solve this problem. I think the values that I ascribe are actually clearly derived from PSB, public purpose and public service, and Prosser and Bourne, usefully put those into three general categories of universality, citizenship, and quality, which have got to underpin, what is actually floating around the public service communication network or infrastructure. There's also something about governance that we need to address. How do you actually ensure that this is actually independent? And of course, the content itself. So I'm just going to briefly talk about some of those ideas very, very quickly. So in terms of PSC, in terms of PSC, I'm going to talk about public purpose and public service first of all. For PSC in this actual example of the European Union and its social purpose, it actually would have a very definite purpose, that of creating a communicative behavioural space in which both the EU and the EU citizen can engage with each other in a meaningful way. And that's what I'm envisaging. But what it doesn't do, what PSC can't have, is a remit to corrupt the space with particular proselytising, either on behalf of the EU or the EU citizen. It's got to be committed to openness and accountability, but not propaganda or uncritical advocacy. So the content and the public purpose and the public service has to be shaped by particular aims and objectives. If the public purpose then of PSC is actually about enhancing everyday and formal deliberative and participative responsibility in democracy through the promotion of an active EU civil public sphere, for want of a better phrase, then it's going to be about the promotion of social justice as fairness and positive welfare. So it's going to have to be about the mediated movement of knowledge and information from one place to another, and through the mediated reallocation, perhaps, of concrete resources and services from one place to another as well. In other words, PSC would accord with what John Rawls would say, which is that justice is the first virtue of social institutions. So this PSC institution has to have very particular and specific obligations. In terms of governance, then, how is this achieved? Well, it has to be part of everything, but independent of everything, which is kind of very difficult. By governance, I refer to the institutional arguments for the possible management of PSC across the EU in order to enable it to be effective. Andrew Gamble says, of course, that the institutions of governance are wider than government itself and include things such as markets, networks and households, as well as communities and associations. And it's that kind of width of influence, as well of which actually would be about the hypothetical day-to-day management of PSC, which would help to satisfy that criteria of independence. But would the EU PSC have to work with the EU as a regulatory capacity? Well, possibly, because it couldn't be left entirely to its own devices, but actually the EU couldn't actually interfere and intervene. It couldn't be allowed to actually directly manage it. But PSC couldn't also be a communicative spontaneous order facilitated by technology. It's not actually an example of local telematics. So it sort of falls in the middle and is about top-down and bottom-up communication and governance. And there, in the EU context, the principle of subsidiarity is actually, for once, quite helpful, which is the idea that it could go down to, you know, from supranational to local level, an ultra-local level, through different networks of communication. But of course, current EU audiovisual media services policy and information policy actually do not actually understand the potential of PSC. Audiovisual and media services policy are replete with contradictory forces and tensions, which we talked about a great deal in the book. I'll not go over those in details. Equally, information society policies is actually confusing in terms of trying to build an infrastructure that actually promotes both content and, you know, the value of that infrastructure and allows access to it. It's not actually set up, the policy isn't set up to promote something like a PSC infrastructure, as we've already discussed. So where does that leave us then? Well, in one sense, I think obviously the policy that framework that exists at the EU level at the moment is very far away from what I'm talking about today. Also, in terms of the national public service broadcasters, the EU doesn't have competence to actually force national public service broadcasters or even to encourage them to work together as a network or to form one particular EU institution. In some ways, it's easier to tear everything down and start again. But it does strike me that if you did have a big public service communicator funded through public funding, through some sort of mechanism across the EU, a larger PSC organisation of content would be well placed actually to have more power in terms of issues that were raised this morning about, you know, network neutrality, the fact that that's actually disappearing and there could be fast and slow lanes and lack of access and the problems around must-carry rules. The bigger the organisation, the more clout it might have in terms of negotiating space on the internet and may actually be stronger and more able to do something in that way. Of course, what I'm advocating is incredibly far removed from what's happening. You do see in the European context lots of things happening. I mean, I'm not denying that there isn't a push towards communicating with citizens and pushing information out there. There's actually a requirement as well for citizens to respond. But a lot of the things that are happening, upgrading Europe by satellite, talking to journalists, having focus groups and consultations, and of course, you know, the usual plethora of websites, leaflets, booklets, and all that sort of thing, could be useful, but are not sufficient to actually do what I'm suggesting PSC could do. So in terms of content then, what could we say about actual content and public service communication? Well, I'll talk a little bit more about substantive content in a minute, but basically content must be undertaken, or the management of content must be undertaken through the practical application of PSC's public purpose and its governance. In other words, it's coming through those structures that are there, and to actually formulate what you could call a specific EU PSC set of editorial guidelines. And those can be as wide or as broad or as narrow as desirable. Those content guidelines could be aimed at improving the quality of organised mediation, of the movement of information and services around the EU in the way that I've been talking about. Or actually more material to do with reallocation of concrete resources such as goods and other benefit services. So in a way, the sky's the limit in terms of what could be done. And of course, again, there are many things actually falling under that kind of umbrella. But again, they're complicated, they're difficult to access, they're not pulling everything together in the way that I'm advocating. So obviously, when we come to what is the EU's social purpose, we cannot ignore the particularities of the contested nature of the so-called European social model. And when I started thinking about PSC, I think I actually made life incredibly difficult for myself by linking it to Europe, to the EU. I have written about PSC separately and will continue to do so in terms of what its evolution might be outside the EU-specific arena. And I think my life will get a bit easier in some ways. But it just intrigues me that actually at the EU level, You know, the European social model, which, as we know, many commentators have pointed out, that it's not solely European, it's not wholly social, and it's not necessarily a model. But notwithstanding that, they've actually harnessed this. It's used as a way to actually try to pull together a set of social and political objectives about how EU society might aspire and arrange itself for the future. Obviously, the ESM reflects a mixture of values, achievements and goals, all varying in forms and realisation amongst EU member states. And of course, the EU member states, which is where it gets difficult, jealously guard their right to retain their own national configurations of social welfare provision. This raises the problem, of course, of trying to impose what must seem like a unitary model of PSC on a version of on a non-unitary European social model. And to attempt that in practice would be naive. I mean, clearly PSC would have to be flexible and reflect and support cultural diversity and difference. But nevertheless, the broad values that are shared, both in terms of what PSC could be and in terms of what the ESM aspires to, could form the basis of a European conversation. And the ESM isn't working particularly well at the European level, although member states, there's no EU harmonised wage, there's no harmonised health system. There are still targets set by the EU for member states to meet on the basis of things like health and pensions. So the targets are set and member states are actually named and shamed. And these kind of issues concern citizens all the way across the EU. They are common concerns for all, even if they're dealt with in different ways in different member states. So it would seem then that these kind of common concerns already exist and are shared amongst EU citizens. Those who move from one member state to another are already having conversations and concerns about the transferability of pension funds, the quality of healthcare and education. For those who remain in their member states, there are still common concerns that emerge, ranging from farming subsidies and EU funding to quality controls, consumer rights in the internal EU market, transferability on the job market. It's endless. All those things, I think, are where the potential for citizen, real citizen engagement and a real conversation could exist, rather than actually possibly debating the democratic deficit and the way that the institutions are formed, which is where communicative strategies, etc., take us. That more citizens are more likely to be concerned with the fabric of everyday life and how it affects them in their own lived experience than they are in actually really getting to grips with the way that the EU is governed. Now, hopefully, if you start to encourage people to care and to understand the other communities of interest around these common concerns, then it could be that there would be policy pushes which actually then would engender smarter policies, that the citizen would start to have a voice in the policy process because there would be more understanding of what sort of things underpin their choices and their the liveryality of their lives. So at the moment, these particular aims of the European social model are actually not underpinned in any serious way or any coherent way by any kind of EU communication strategy. But they all, I suggest, at some point, if the EU model is to continue, are going to require some form of EU-wide mediation, if only so that people understand that the actual reason for the EU is about getting better quality of life for everybody, that it is about things getting better. Such mediated transactional services, I think, are actually currently only limited by creativity and barriers, which are currently diminishing, to the right kind of interactive technology and access initiatives. And I think I've got a couple of minutes. Yeah. Of course, in reality, the EU social agenda shows no sign of such adjustments and does not regard such social problems as being ameliorated by something like PSC, which is quite frustrating when you look at what policy processes and what policy objectives and the rhetoric that are in play at the European level. And that stretches right across its media policy and its social policy. In addition, of course, with the EU, there's always the psychological, political and cultural barrier to any kind of thing that PSC EU social purpose would actually seem to imply. And again, Roger Silverstone, I think, summarises this when he says about of the EU, there is no magic here, and I have no intention of romanticising European society. If such a thing exists at all, it is far from harmonious and far from coherent culturally. Most of the attempts to create a pan-European broadcast environment have failed, for obvious, most significantly linguistic reasons. The media spaces in individual nations are still entirely dominated by the mainstream national and transnational broadcasters, internet service providers and global search engines. So, of course, on the one hand, we could leave it there and say that the EU has, amongst its many problems, a communication deficiency that cannot be overcome. Certainly, past attempts to harness the power of broadcasting have been abandoned, and the EU audiovisual policy has migrated away from attempts to use public service broadcasting and broadcasters to foster EU social cohesion and identity, to the establishment of a common minimum standards and the removal of regulatory barriers to establish a single audiovisual market. The whole thing shifted enormously since the first visions of what actually EU broadcasting could be all about. But on the other hand, I think we could return to something else that Roger Silverstone says, when he says that the total media environment is being transformed by the changing habits and desires of audiences and readers and technology, and that it is possible that a media plurality, in my case a new EU media plurality, can accommodate our living together, where the media in their capacity for hospitality and justice can be enabling rather than disabling, to which I would also add, enabling of a European society. So just to finish, my argument is theoretical, of course, but that does not mean that what it advocates is unachievable. A European public service communicator can be envisaged, even though it faces from the start problems of political will and the allocation of resources, problems of definition and scope and application. But nonetheless, despite this problem that I've obviously set myself, we do need to consider the need for what I think Graham described as yesterday as a public philosophy of convergence. Maybe thinking about this in terms of the EU is unnecessarily difficult, but PSC as a concept and the extent to which it is possible, I believe, is limited only by imagination. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jackie. We don't need